I would be glad to get started just because the other day when I gave this workshop, we did run out of time, and I didn't get to say some things that I thought were kind of important at the end, and so I'd like to get started. Before we do, let's pray. Lord, this morning as we have come before you, we are thankful for the way that you made us each individually, and that you, the way you made each of our students, and each one of them brings their own things into our lives, whether they be gifts or whether we view them as problems. And I just pray, Lord, today that as we struggle as teachers at times with our struggling students, help us to be wise and to know how to make a difference in their lives. Help us to work together this morning and to bless your name in what we're able to do. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, first of all, the struggling student, and Anthony brought this topic to me and wondered if I would consider addressing it. And as I came here to FB and I started talking with a lot of people that I knew and a lot of people I didn't know, I thought that maybe next year they ought to do a session on the struggling teacher. Because I did find myself there this past year, a struggling teacher that I'm afraid is maybe too close to burnout. But a couple things. The first one I'd like to address is, why is this student in my classroom struggling? There might be a significant change in the home routine. Maybe there's a baby been born. Maybe mom's off taking care of grandma or something. Some of those things can make a difference, or experience a recent trauma. In the last couple years, I had a boy in my classroom, and his father died of cancer in February, and that was a jolt. The very next year, I had a girl who very unexpectedly lost her mother, and that was a huge jolt. But these two students both came from good families, and so I found that they ended up with fewer struggles, many fewer struggles, than some of my other students did. And there are some reasons. Or maybe there's been a legitimate health concern. The other day I heard this story that this past year a student came to school, not in our school, but a student came to a school and told the teacher, or told the other students, and the teacher overheard it, that last night mom and dad had a fight. And dad said, "You want to live with me?" And the question was posed to me, what do we do about that? And I've mauled that thing for a couple days, and I think that maybe the answer is, that's not your problem. Now, it surely is going to have some effects in your classroom. But maybe, you know, Jesus didn't, we don't get the idea that Jesus healed everybody that he met up with that had issues. What about the pool of Bethesda? He healed one man. Maybe this isn't your problem. There might be a learning difficulty and there might be a learning disability, and I'd like to differentiate between the two. We have a girl in our school who is the age of a ninth grader, I think. She's probably pushing 15, 16 years of age. She, for probably 3 or 4 years, did a second grade math book. I think she's doing a third grade math book again this year. She has a learning difficulty. She has a limited IQ. We can do everything that we want for her, and she will never attain even a fifth grade level. A learning disability is interesting because when you give the student with a learning difficulty and a student with a learning disability the same IQ test, they might register nearly the same. The difference is when I talk to this girl that we call her in seventh grade, but she's special ed, she can't communicate with you on even a fifth or sixth grade level. When I talk with a student that has a learning disability, Some of them are very intelligent, and just by conversing with them, you understand that. But for some reason, when they take that IQ test, there is some disconnect upstairs that they will test out about the same as a student with a learning difficulty. I remember years ago, I had a student in my classroom, and by the way, this man today is a very productive citizen. He's the father of one of my students. He's a good church member. He's a good dad. He's a good husband. His IQ score was a 78. And if you know anything about IQ scores, below an 80 is considered special ed. He's not special ed. He's much more intelligent than that. But I believe that there is disconnect upstairs, and it still manifests itself today. And so that's the difference between a learning disability and a learning difficulty. And then the last item is the student that doesn't have a motivation, doesn't have a drive. He sees no future in his education. He has no desire or doesn't want to expend the effort that is needed to accomplish what needs to be done. This session is being recorded, and because of that, I want to be careful, because I almost need to speak from my own experiences, and yet I don't mean to exploit anybody back home. That's the last thing that I would want to do. But I will mention a few items about some people that have been in my classroom. First of all, I'd like to talk about different learning styles. There are a number of different learning styles, and depending on who you listen to, they say learning styles are so important, and other people say, this is all an idea of a trend, a fad that is here today and will be gone in 10 years, and there's really nothing to it. I've heard both sides of the argument. But I think there is some validity to it, and I'd like to talk about that just very briefly. A kinesthetic learner is a hands-on learner. These students, if you only have an overhead, they don't do that well with it. And here, this is probably overstated. I have overheads are a poor tool. Let me retract that. I wish I could undo that a little bit. If you only use an overhead, if your overhead moves, or if you are working on an overhead projector and you actually are working a problem on there, that's great because there's activity and they function on activity. These students are probably the ones who need more hands-on, more of a chance to practice what you've just taught them than other students do. These students function well with a highlighter. But you know, I teach grades 5 and 6, and with a highlighter, you know what students do, right? What's that? They color everything, and it becomes totally ineffective. So make sure that they only hit key items. Tell them to limit, and you might have to teach them some of these things, because this year, because of some things that have taken place in our school, I have learned that I need to be teaching some things that I never thought I would need to teach. So it is. A visual learner is one who learns by seeing, and if these students are required to go to their book and read, and they're supposed to get all of their own information by reading by themselves, they don't function well. They need someone up front, a warm body up front, who's going to show them, who's going to tell them. And I found that these students sometimes do well by also, instead of just seeing something, they benefit also by doing things orally, doing things out loud. And I've even had some of these students go back to the office and just read something out loud to themselves back there, because they benefit in using that. But also, they function well with a blackboard, with you doing something on the blackboard and making it visual. There are other students who say, you know, I really don't need that. I need to hear it. And actually, I got mixed up just a little bit there. But yeah, I need to hear it. And interestingly, these people need to hear it more than once. So I hope with your auditory learners that you are reviewing with them, because they do need to hear it a number of times. Also, describe it. Get them involved, get them to discuss it with you. But now the issue is, no student can learn everything by their desired learning style. As I gave the example on Tuesday, how do you teach a student what Ohio looks like if they're a kinesthetic learner? Do you have them trace the outline of Ohio? You could. You could. But can you do that with everything? No. Mostly for Ohio, we're going to look at this shape and say, that's Ohio. And so a student has to be flexible, but for you as a teacher, I'm going to say that the more learning styles that you can incorporate in your teaching, the more students you're going to be effective for. Let's talk about ADHD, and I'd like to just tell you, I'm not going to deal with ADHD, but it's an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And these symptoms, the students that have these symptoms are usually related to inattention. They have a difficult time focusing. They want to move from item to item to item. I have there's a lady that I know, a non-Mennonite lady, and she's a grandma, and she said, I had my grandchildren this weekend, and she said, they drove me nuts. And I said, how old are they? And she said, I think she said 13, 11, and 10. And I said, so what was wrong with the weekend? She says, well, I love to have them. But she said, they are so used to activity, activity, activity. And she said, I think it stems from the fact that they're constantly playing video games. But she said, they can't sit. They can't carry a conversation. If we start a conversation, they're up, they're about. They can't focus. And, you know, if you've ever had a parent yourself who said, you know, that's about enough time. Why don't you go do something more constructive? Bless your parents. Maybe you didn't see the value at the time. These students can also be sluggish, though. But inattention is, again, the issue there. I'd like to talk a bit about dyslexia. And this morning, I don't want to just capitalize on dyslexia. But I'll tell you what makes this a real part of my session today. We have had some students for a number of years. And the man that I told you about that was in my classroom years ago with an IQ of 78, in Dutch, we would have just said he was hotlanig. Or if you don't understand that one, it's just a difficult time to learn. And the issue there is that had I known what I know now, I would say that man has the symptoms of dyslexia. And what's interesting about dyslexia, it is a genetic problem. Today, two of his four children manifest that same issue. Originally, I was a bit turned off by the term dyslexia because it seems to be the current box that catches all the problems. Every time a student has a problem today, they're dyslexic. As a matter of fact, I had a student this past year, and his mother told me that he was dyslexic. That was a self-diagnostic. The mother did the diagnosis there. In looking at the symptoms of dyslexia, I don't agree. I won't tell her that, but I disagree because he does not have the symptoms of a dyslexic student. He does have some issues, but if he does have dyslexia, it's mild, and it doesn't carry many of the symptoms that are usually there. Let's take a look at these. These are warning signs of dyslexia as a preschooler. First of all, there's a delayed speech as a small child. They mix up sounds and syllables, and they're late in establishing a dominant hand. They have confusion of left and right. And you say, that's me as an adult. Please, don't overdo it, or we will all be dyslexic. Why do I say that? I think, again, that everybody looks and wants to identify the problem and categorize it. And I know of two brothers living in another community that have been, quote, diagnosed as being dyslexic. Have they had the testing done? No. But by a lodge in their local town, they have been viewed and they are exhibiting the symptoms of dyslexia. And because of that, the lodge members are saying, we really don't care to put a label on you. So they never call the boys dyslexic. They just take them into their center in the evening and tutor them. And that's really what we're after anyway. Why put a handle on a child? Learning to tie their shoes. Seriously, I had a boy in my classroom years ago, fifth grade, and I ended up helping him learn how to tie his shoes. What had been done before that? Mom always bought him Velcro shoes. I'm serious. Instead of really working with the issue, you just avoid the issue, circumvent it. The problem is, guess what? The issue's there the lifelong. And so somewhere, if this boy is going to avoid wearing Velcro shoes or slip-on shoes for the rest of his life, somewhere we need to teach him how. And he could be taught. It just took more time than it did for the average student. Difficulty with rhyming words. My question to you, are there first grade teachers in here? I'm curious. Okay, we have a few. Are you dealing with rhyming words? I was not aware how big an issue this is. But if you would ask some students for a rhyming word with time, they might say it's talk, where time and dime rhyme, but they say time and talk rhyme because they're listening for one sound and then guessing at the rest. Difficulty memorizing their address, their telephone number, the alphabet, or, as I mentioned earlier, a close relative with dyslexia. And I've also found this, if you have any number of children in a family, usually if there is dyslexia there, there's probably more than one. It's very unusual to have a family of, let's say, five children and only one dyslexic one. But let's talk about memorizing the address. That same boy that couldn't tie his shoes, he came to my classroom, fifth grade, and did not know his telephone number. And so I tried to create a need, and I said, are you aware that students today in kindergarten in public schools are required to know their telephone number? No. And I said, well, that is a truth, and I'd like you to know your telephone number. Neither did he know his address. Neither did he know his grandfather's name. His grandfather's name was Grandpa. And neither did he know his grandpa's phone number. So this all came out one evening after school, then that he needed to call his mom, and he couldn't get a hold of his mom. So I said, why don't you call your grandma? And I said, so what's their phone number? And he said, I don't know. So I said, well, let's look it up in the phone book. And I just left him thinking that he would look it up in the phone book. And he came to me 2 minutes later, and he says, I don't know how to find it in the phone book. And so then I started asking some questions. I said, do you know your grandpa's name? And he says, it's Grandpa. So we found it in the phone book. And then I started working with him on his own phone number. And I explained to him there's the Area Exchange 873. And by the way, to this day, I know his phone number. And then after we had the 873 and understood that, we added the other four numbers to it. And then after that was all accomplished, I explained to him. Now, this didn't happen in one day, trust me. After that, I explained to him that there's an area code, and you need to learn 614 also. And he's like, why? And I said, well, if you were in Indiana, and you were attempting to call home, if you dialed your 7-digit phone number, it would never go through because you've got to get into the right area code. So he had to memorize 10 digits altogether. And this was big for him. And his numbers were difficult for him. The warning signs of dyslexia in elementary school, and let me mention this. I am disappointed in our school, and please hear me out in this. We have a great first and second grade teacher who's probably taught for 15 years or so, and a third and fourth grade teacher who's taught at least that many, probably closer to 20, 25 years. I don't know. But they do an extremely good job. But we still have students coming up through, and I'll talk about something in just a moment. They letter a number of reversals. Now, that happens in first grade B and D. And, you know, that's very common. But past first grade, that is an issue if they show that sign. Dysgraphia, which is, and you have these students who have this very disjointed handwriting. It seems hard as they try. They can't write smoothly or neatly. And, you know, I can deal with that. Let them put forth the effort, but don't require from them what you're going to require from maybe everybody else. Poor spelling. And I found out one of the reasons for that poor spelling is And I'll talk a little bit later about what we are using as a solution. But that poor spelling comes across is that they have a difficult time parroting back what a therapist has dealt with. And let me give you an example. The student in my classroom that probably has the biggest issue with dyslexia, his therapist, which is a volunteer mother in our school, his therapist said she had a paper and he was supposed to, she had three letters at the top and it was like an F, M, and a P. And what he did not see the letters. And she just said, repeat after me. F-m-p. And he would say, F-p-m. Would get those three mixed up. And she tried it a number of times with different letters, even with the same letters, and time after time, he would mix up the second and third one. He couldn't do it. And this is a boy that I've taught for 2 years, and this is a boy who is not a slouch, who is one who doesn't care. He really put forth effort, and that's the only reason he got as far in life as he did. I'd like to tell you a little wonder story. This boy also really struggled with Bible memory. And his dad, interestingly enough, showed signs of dyslexia back when he was in school also. But this boy, my students normally have 4 verses a week for Bible memory. And his dad came to me one day and he said, John, what do I do? His dad's real high strung and he says, what do I do? He said, we worked all weekend on this new Bible memory. And he said, we went over it time after time after time. And he said, I know it. And my son doesn't. Writing is helpful. But one thing that I've done, and I do this with poor spelling also, if they are struggling with spelling, let's say they have the word discontinuity. First of all, I'll make sure that they understand why these letters say what they do. And by the way, the word dysgraphia is a common one because a student, if they just heard, a fifth grader, if they heard the word dysgraphia, they'd probably want to spell it D-I-S. But the Y here is my vowel. And the P-H is the F sound. And so, you know, what I'll have them do is take their new words home on the weekend and they're to write their words, let's say, once on Friday evening. And as they write the word, they are writing, they're saying the word out loud, syllable by syllable, as they write that syllable. So it's discontinuity. And I'll have them do it again on Saturday. Don't have them do it twice in a row. It's much better to have them do it at two different times because it brings it to their remembrance two different times instead of all at one time. The other thing, look for the little words inside the big words because those are things that help them to find a key to stroke to spelling. These students with dyslexia also cannot tell time unless you give them a digital clock. But I've found that even with a digital clock, they're lost because how much time is there from 11:45 to 12 o'clock? And they can usually, if they've been in school any length of time, they can tell you it's 15 minutes. But I'd say, how long is 15 minutes? They have no clue. And I found this by saying, well, you said you studied last night. How long did you study? Do you think you... I don't know. Do you think you studied 5 minutes or 15 minutes or half an hour? How long? Well, I don't know. And it's amazing because time periods don't seem to be relevant to them at all. They skip or misread small words when they're reading. I remember the student I had who struggled with her oral reading, and one of the things my students need to do is to read their story before, pre-read it before we get to class. And so I asked her to read her story at home, out loud. And so she was at home in the kitchen, at the table, reading the story, mom's cooking and mom's thinking everything's going great. And finally she walks over there to see what her daughter's reading, and then mom came to me later and she says, you know, I thought my daughter was doing a great job until I looked at what she was supposed to be reading. The words that were coming out of her mouth and the words on the page, especially the prepositions and the conjunctions, were not the same words. And what these dyslexic students will often do is they'll grasp for pictures. They will look at keywords in the story and invent the rest of it. Another thing, some of them have a great handle on memorization because do they learn science facts? No. They memorize them long enough to deal with the test, and then they're gone. We had a high school student years ago, and she came in, and her teacher was talking to her in the morning. He said, "Don't talk to me." And later, he found out why. She said, "I don't study my social studies because it doesn't do any good. So the night before the test, I go back home and I reread the whole chapter. And I didn't want you talking to me this morning because it would make me forget what I had learned until after I had taken the test." Is that knowledge going to be there next day? No, it isn't. They often deal with, they have problems with learning cursive handwriting. Multiplication tables are very difficult. Trouble with directionality. I use Saxon Math, and if the student doesn't like their test score, they can opt for a Form B, which is similar to Form A, and I'll take the higher of the two scores. So this boy that was in my class, he did not want to keep his Form A score. He wanted to try for a Form B. So I said, "Keith, write your name on the line." And so, I said, "Right behind your name, put a big blue B if you want a Form B." And the first time this happened, there was a B in front of his name. And it's like no big deal. The next time it happened, I thought, what is going on? And about the third time or fourth time it happened, I said, "Keith," I said, "I noticed you put your B in front of your name." "Oh." And even after that, he did it once or twice. So the third and fourth grade teacher is his therapist for the summer. And I had alerted her that Keith struggles with directionality. She told me recently, she said, one morning she just said, "Keith, write your name on the line." And he did. And then she said, "Put a box behind your name." And he put a box behind his name. And then she said, "Put a star in front of your name." And he says, "That's so confusing to me. I didn't realize that as a fifth or sixth grade teacher, I needed to teach that, but I really did need to for him." She did this. She said, "Keith, before you came to school this morning, you ate breakfast. After you go home today, you're going to eat lunch." "Oh, okay." And then the next day that he came for therapy, she asked him about it, and he said, "And that made it so clear when you explained to me about lunch and breakfast." So now he understands before and after. And yet, here he was in my classroom, and I had no clue. He didn't know that. I felt bad about it. Homonyms, throw them off. Do I use T-H-E-R-E, T-H-E-I-R, or T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E? Messy room, backpack, messy locker, messy desk. But Keith wasn't that way at all. Very neat. So these students are not going to exhibit all the symptoms, and if you only are having a student exhibiting one or two symptoms, don't get worried about it. Let's talk about some solutions, and if you'll notice, I put the word solutions inside quotes, because these are some struggles I've had, and they work with some students, they don't work with other students, and since this is a workshop, I'd really love to have your input, maybe some things that have worked for you, some things that haven't worked for you. But be prepared to spend time with LD students, because if there's one thing that you're that's probably going to take, it's going to be time and your effort. And it's probably going to take your patience, and because if you get uptight with these students, they probably are just not going to function at all. Differentiate. And if you are reading any academic material today, you'll find that differentiating is a key word, the trend word of today. And differentiating is just a matter of saying, this student is able to do this, this student is not able to do this much, and so I will differentiate and give this student less. That's a great idea, provided it's needed. If you have a lazy student, differentiating is not what you should be doing because they need the whole load. But with Keith, I cut his Bible memory back to 2 verses. And the interesting thing is, after he started with therapy and cutting back his Bible memory to 2 verses, would you believe that 2 weeks in a row he said his Bible memory word perfect? And that was unheard of. So I think there's some hope here. A number of years ago, I had a student who came to us middle of the year, middle of fifth grade, right after Christmas. He came from a public school in a different state, and he came with literally an LD folder this thick. Had all the diagnostic done. And we decided that we are going to treat him. Before he ever came, we knew about this issue. He had a gifted sister also. We decided that we are going to treat him like everybody else until we have a reason not to. And so he came into my classroom, and the first spelling list we had, 20 words, and trial test came on a Tuesday, and he got 2 words right. And I thought, wow. So I worked with him some, and on Thursday we had the final test, and he had 4 words correct. And those 4 did not include the 2 correct ones that he had had on Tuesday. And we soon saw that things were going to have to be done differently. And one of the things that we did is he was totally lost in English. And my co-teacher in fourth grade said, I think what he needs is the fourth grade book. It's a very basic book. And so what we did is a tutor one-on-one took this young man and tutored him the rest of that year. And then for the majority of his sixth grade, he was in the fifth grade book. And he worked diligently until he caught up with the fifth graders. And then he joined the fifth grade class. And then when he went into seventh grade, he actually started with a seventh grade grammar book. And I will tell you, this young man never, and he was a hard worker, but he never became an A student. He never became someone outstanding. But he graduated with the rest of his class, and you would have never known that he had a thick folder in his file. Why? And I have praised his tutor many times, and he also is aware that his tutor is the one person in his life that probably made the biggest difference academically that has ever happened. Also, vary your style. You know, your content is somewhat locked in. Who, the students? You don't have a choice. But your style? Who said that you always have to teach the same way every day? Who always said you have to teach in the style that's most comfortable for you? Maybe if you step out of your box and operate a little differently, you're going to attract some attention from a student, and they're going to learn in a way that they never learned before. Stir their curiosity. What if? And I'm going to ask you a question. I'd like a response. What if in the French and Indian War, the French had won the war and the English had lost? What if? Did you ever think about that? We probably would be speaking French. Exactly. That's the first and most obvious one. And words like plateau would look like they're spelled correctly. Be an encourager. Be a Barnabas. These students have a lot of weaknesses. And believe it or not, they know their weaknesses. And you look at your other students, and they know the poor students' weaknesses also. And is that bad? No. That's the way you develop community in your classroom. If you have a student in there with a broken leg, everybody wants to open the door for them. But that is something that'll develop community. And where do we need a better picture of community than our schools? Because our schools are going to become the church. And where do we need a stronger picture of community than in our churches? You've got people in your churches with all kinds of needs and gifts and weaknesses, and that's where community comes into play. enlisting the help of some parents. The unfortunate one is where the parent is much so willing to help, but really the only thing they're wanting to accomplish is helping Johnny get the correct answer in the blank. And unfortunately, that student comes back with a paper, and you can tell right away whether it was done at home or whether it was done at school. And that's unfortunate, because when mom provides that crutch, she's actually hurting the student and not helping him. And I have, in extreme cases, said, I want you to do this paper all by yourself. The other thing that I've told students is, I have time to answer your question. If you're not going to give me an opportunity to answer your question, I don't want you to give your mom an opportunity to answer the question. Now, because there have been students who have purposely run home with a question, knowing they had the question at that time, knowing that mom is going to do the thinking for them, I'm not going to do the thinking for them. I'm going to help them, but I'm not going to do the thinking for them. And I'd like to give you a prime example of what I'm saying about doing the thinking for them. Mom said, remember, mom said her son is dyslexic. I disagree. Our math book uses this approach, and I ran across this toward the end of the year. But when we are wanting to add integers, so here we have this problem of a negative 3 and a positive 5. And the question is posed, so which team is going to win, the negatives or the positives? And the answer is, the positives are, because there are more of them. Well, by how much are the positives going to win? By 2. So if I take negative 3 plus a positive 5, I'm going to get a positive 2. Okay? So we went over this, and the class thought it was good, it was easy. But he kept missing these problems. And the next day, I'd say, okay, who's going to win? And he'd say, the positives. By how much? And he'd say, by 2. And he knew the answer. But then next day, he'd miss the problem again. So after this went on for a few days, I asked him, I said, how'd you do your assignment? And he said, well, I just did it. And I said, did you ask yourself the questions that you're supposed to be asking? He said, no, I just did it. And I said, I thought, wait a minute. What I've been doing is I have been asking him those questions every day, and he's getting it correctly. Getting it correct. So I asked him, okay, I said, what are the two questions you should be asking yourself? And he said, who's going to win? I said, that's right. And who is going to win? And he told me, what's the next question? And he said, by how much? He could do that problem perfectly fine. But as long as I was willing to ask him the leading questions, he was willing to let me do it. And that's where the help, whether it's you or it's me or it's a parent or it's whoever, the student needs to do their own thing. I have a close relative who is a prof in a college. And I asked her this question. I said, so what would you do with students in this issue, in this situation? And she said, well, I would have the students work together. And that is a common trend. And I asked her this question quite pointedly. I said, what's going to happen, honestly, what's going to happen if you pair that excellent student and the poor student on a fifth or sixth grade level? And she said, well, she said, probably the better student is going to end up doing the majority of the work. And I said, that's right. I agree with you. And don't get me wrong. I think there's a time for students to work together. But if the better student is doing all the thinking and the majority of the thinking and the majority of the work, especially if this is an unmotivated student, they're going to be willing to coast, because that's probably what they're doing a lot of the time anyway. When my students meet up with a new word, give them a handle. I just pause. If we're working with something in class, and especially if I'm reading something, I require the students to follow along as I read. And if I'm reading something, I meet up with a new word, I just pause, and 3 weeks into school, they know by that time that they're supposed to repeat the word back to me. So it's science class, and I run across the word paleontologist. And I, you know, after I've read the word paleontologist, I just pause, and they repeat it back to me. Because sometimes if you always say the word and never give them a chance to say it, especially your dyslexic students, will jumble, transpose syllables, or even letters that aren't even there, but they will not say the word correctly. So teach them to say the word correctly just by having them mimic you as you say it. And the other thing is, you say, well, now I can say the word, but I'm not going to remember how to pronounce it tomorrow. Well, with paleontologists, I did this. I said, you know, there's a dairy farmer down the road. His name is Leon. And you owe Leon money. And so what are you going to do? You are going to pay Leon. And the tologist comes along, and it's okay. And the next day, they all knew how to say paleontologist. I remember something my 8th grade teacher used to teach us the different divisions of the classification system. You know, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. King Philip came over for green spinach. It's there. And they, some of them have actually forgotten the different steps of the classification system, but they could tell me the sentence. So, but usually, if you give them a handle of that nature, some kind of memory peg, they will learn from it, and it will stay there. Use logic. We run across a story problem in math, and the story problem says that, you know, mom bought bananas, 3 pounds of bananas for 29 cents a pound. I say, how about 29 cents a pound? Would you buy bananas for 29 cents a pound? Is that a good price, bad price, you know? The majority of the students say, I don't know. Okay, so you and your dad go to McDonald's, and he buys you a Big Mac. What do you pay for the sandwich? I don't know. Get them into the real life, because after all, what are we doing? We're trying to get them ready for real life. And coming into this also, require those students to be punctual with their work. And, you know, Johnny can't understand why he needs to hand this paper in on time. I said, you know what happens to me when I don't pay my credit card bill on time? The next bill comes along, there's a $39 charge for being one day late on that credit card bill. Now, if I call in, guess what? They'll say, Mr. Troyer, and I've already done this. Mr. Troyer, we looked at your history, and it's great. We'll take that right off. Thank you for using our card. But guess what? Guess what if I had a history of that? They'd say, we're sorry. It'll be $39. That's the real world. Don't pay your electric bill. See what happens. Know your students, and I think that's what Kyle was talking about. Take an interest in them. Have them see you as a person rather than that creature that just assigns work and expects assignments. Be one of them without being their buddy, of course. And then let struggling students know your expectations of them, and also know their expectations, because some students... Really, I'm thinking of a girl that I had a number of years ago, and she did the work with the rest of the class, but she really struggled, and she had some issues, which were beyond her control. But what really, the one that she told me that kind of upset me, is so we are approaching a test, and I'm quizzing her one on one. On some information on the science test that's coming up, and she is lost. And so I asked her, have you been studying? And she said, no. And I asked her, why not? Because I have a classroom policy that daily you study. Daily. Not wait till the test, but daily you study. And she said, well, I knew I was going to get a bad grade on the test anyway, so why study? That's getting defeated before you ever get started. And that, you know, you're not going to go anywhere with that in life. So... But do have some realistic expectations for people like this. And be as concrete as you can be. If you are just talking, you're going to need to demonstrate. especially for these poor students. Make it as concrete as possible. And also, make sure that they are mastering the material that you're giving them. What I like to do is when I'm having, let's say, an English class, I like to circulate and just see what's going on their desk, what kind of work that they're putting down there. And I'll even circulate with a red pen and say, "May I grade?" And they'll say, "Sure." And you're just going down the row. Well, that way, number two is wrong, and if they miss number two, they might miss number three, four, five, they might miss a number of them. But if I can get it right there, nip it in the bud, and the other thing is, so I've graded three of your answers, and they're all right. How do you feel about yourself? You feel like, hey, I know what I'm doing. Gives you the confidence you need to go on. And then when you review, I said when you review, because I think that review is the greatest portion of your teaching that is going to make work information stick with your students. Review and don't use the same examples you used yesterday. Try to vary your style, try to vary your information, try to put it in a different way. If you're always asking, "What's the capital of Ohio?" and they're going to say Columbus, the next day ask them, "Columbus is the capital of what state?" Make sure that you vary. And I've had parents who have helped students study in preparation for a test. And I had one mom who said, "My daughter got mad at me because I would not ask the question word for word that was on the paper." Well, the problem is, if the question on the test is not word for word, she's lost. And she was studying merely to pass a test. And these students that have difficulties might also know information one day and not know it the next day. The girl that's in special ed, she has struggled with multiplication tables, and she might know her 1 through 5 family for 3-4 days in a row. And the next day, all of a sudden, she doesn't know half of them. And she almost has to relearn them. And so that's going to happen with some of these poor students. I want to go on. I have some things that I want to talk about in relation to dyslexia. But I'd like to talk, first of all, about students with motivational problems, because I think that that is an issue that you might face. I think probably every teacher faces that. But what do you do with a student that doesn't hand in papers at all, or hands in incomplete work, doesn't meet deadlines? What do you do? I'm curious. Do you become their slave? Do you let them just do it at their own leisure and hand it in and get full credit? I don't think you should, because I think you should make exceptions and do that, yes. But on a regular basis, I don't think you should do that, because what you do is you end up becoming an enabler. You allow them then to daily or weekly hand in late papers. I have it here, and this is actually a co-teacher of mine. She put it this way: create a grading system that makes later incomplete work the student's problem, not your problem. Because when they hand in late papers, guess who spends the extra time? You do. Because you again pull out that teacher's manual, and you again need to find out how many points were on that. You need to get to that part of your grade book to enter that score. You end up doing all the extra work. And the student goes on their merry way. They haven't suffered a bit. That late work needs to be their problem, not yours. And the other thing that I find difficult is leaving my emotions out of it, because I tend to shoulder the responsibility then, because I feel bad for the student. And I remember this past year, I give my students a certain number of late papers, and when they're exhausted, and they know how many late papers they get, and when they've used them, and when they've exhausted it, whatever's not done will be done, and you will only receive half credit for the part that wasn't done. And the mom came crying to me because her son got, you know, a 40 on his math grade. What's 140 out of 30 grades for a grading period? If the other 29 grades are reasonable, that 140 is not going to do much. Now, I will look at it differently if it's a music grade, because they don't nearly have 30 music grades in a grading period. But the flip side of it is, I once taught with a teacher who took every failing grade and had the student redo the work and average the two grades. And so here, Junior had a 69, did it over and pulled a 100. And when you do the average, he's got an 85. And at the end of the school year, she said, this little guy is not ready to be advanced to the next grade. So she approached the parents about retaining him. And the parents said, look at his report card. He's got an 88 average. The 88 was an invalid picture of what the work he was really doing. And so in a case like, let's say they get a bad grade in music, fail a music grade, I will let them redo the problems. And if their average is above a 70, a 70 is what I put in the grade book. It's still helping them out. But you can fudge grades that they show an unreal picture. Set short-range goals. I had a boy in my class, and I love to tell stories, but this boy was in fourth grade. He could mess around like you have never seen before. And his teacher had him stay after school. And literally, he could sometimes sit there till 6:30 in the evening, finishing his day's work. I can't handle that. I love my students dearly, but come 3:30, I need some time to myself. And so after a few struggles with this, a few attempts at encouragement, and just getting nowhere, I said, tomorrow morning, our school starts at 9 o'clock. I said, tomorrow morning, instead of being here at 9, I want you here at 8. Because what we're going to do at 8 o'clock, there are quite a number of review problems in our math lesson. And you can work on those review problems before the other students ever get here. Now, this boy was not a morning person, trust me. He would get up just in time to get to school on time. Oh, that did not sit well, but he was there. And this happened about 3 or 4 days. And you know, the problem, I can't say that it got strongly solved, but it got to the point where it was manageable. And his work speed and effort was manageable. Where he knew that if he messes around today, he'll be there in the morning before at 8 o'clock. And again, I was hesitant to do that, but there comes a time when you have to do. His mom was in the same boat. If he took homework home, he was at it till midnight. Not quite. But he was at it till 9 o'clock, doing 45 minutes work. That becomes such a drag on the student himself because he feels so overwhelmed by something he has no need to feel overwhelmed about. So what I do, tell them, I do this especially in September. You know, in 10 minutes, I'm going to come around the room. Just see what you have done. Am I being threatening? I hope not. I don't intend to be at all. But if they know that my surveillance will be there in 10 minutes, it's amazing to see what they've got done. So use it as an encouragement. And then use some extrinsic motivational methods, but they usually do end up running aground to somewhat. One thing that I try to avoid doing is putting each person that in the classroom individually on the same level. Because here's Susie, and she cannot do what Katie does. It's impossible. So maybe you can motivate them by rewarding them if they supersede what they've done previously. Or something else I've done is made teams. And the team works together. This was really funny because this past year I had a student named Sean, and Sean was really quite bright, came into my class, and after a few days I decided, this guy should be a straight-A student, and he wasn't. And after, it was about January or so that I made these math teams, and to see, we would accumulate their score for one day, the whole team's score, and see who could come up with the highest number. And that was the reward, just see who could come up with the highest score. Sean, would you believe, started pulling 100s. And I started inquiring, said, Sean, what are you doing? And he said, I checked over my math lesson 3 times last night, voluntarily. There was no reward except that he knew he would contribute to his team's well-being. Maybe you have some questions, maybe you have some comments. What do you do with your students that are motivationally challenged? There's something I'd like to talk about, and that is about working with these dyslexic students. But something I forget to mention earlier, and this I think works well with a kinesthetic learner. I've encouraged my students after their writing lesson is writing their spelling words in good form, that they air write the word with their finger. And I often have students who, after they're done with their writing paper, they'll be air writing the word. And this is again, putting it into their mind. I have a book here. It's actually a friend's book. It's Overcoming Dyslexia by Sally Shaywitz, and the bibliography is there. This is an excellent book. I have not read the book, but I've read good portions of it. And this book has some. And if you think that you're going to get a quick fix handle on overcoming dyslexia, you won't. But this does give some good information. Another thing that we have done is worked with Susan Barton. And Susan Barton is a program, and the website is there. Susan Barton's a program that has some good things going for it, and that is what our mothers are using in therapy with our students, with a few of our students that are showing dyslexic symptoms. It is not a cheap course. And by the way, I'll tell you how we acquired our Susan Barton information, or our program, is box tops. Do your students cut box tops? Familiar with that? Tissue boxes. Every time a tissue box is empty, it does not go in the trash can. It goes on the shelf until somebody with free time has time to cut the box top out of the bottom. Every box top's a dime. Make it known to your churches. Soup cans often have a label on them and some box tops are worth like 3 box tops. We collect box tops. It's amazing how many you get. We bought our risers for a high school course a couple years ago with box tops completely. $1,800. We bought Susan Barton materials with box tops. It's amazing. They add up. That really has proved to be to have some good things going for it. The other thing that I'd like to draw to you, and by the way, this handout was just something that we downloaded, but there's some information on here that you as a teacher could well utilize. The rhythmic writing, and this is by Paula Seibel, and I do not know Paula Seibel. One of my co-teachers does personally, and there are some interesting things here that have happened. The one boy that was in my class, before we knew about this, his mother was taking him driving 1 hour a day to another town, Xenia, Ohio, and was taking him to therapists, and they were literally spending $100 a week plus the gas to drive him 50 miles, and on another day doing the same. He was doing it twice a week. And one of the things that they were doing with him in therapy is spending 10 to 15 minutes daily. And even when he did not have, even on the days he did not have therapy, there's elusive Chuck out here. Even on the days he did not have therapy, he needed to practice this at home, but he was drawing figure eights. And they recommend a chalkboard, not a marker board, not paper and pencil. They suggest drawing it big. And on here is criteria for how they should be drawing it. And I'm not well versed in this, but this boy was going this way, and he has to say, I'm going right, left, right,
left, right, left. And he does that for 10 to 15 minutes. And when he got good at it, by the way, to start with, you don't tell them they're going the wrong, they're saying the wrong thing, because this is something that often happens. They'll say left. You don't say, all you say is direction. Make them think about what they're doing. And then after he had learned this, she was giving him math problems while he's doing this, saying left and right and drawing these figure eights, and he's spitting out answers. Now, this is the same boy who couldn't do column addition in my classroom because he was so disorganized. We had to give him graph paper, and that was his therapist's recommendation. Give him graph paper to do his problems on, because he can keep things lined up that way. And this guy started spouting. Now, to tell you how intelligent this guy is, as a fourth grader, we saw two fourth grade boys, he and another boy, arguing about what, you know, in the United States, ships are named USS whatever. They were arguing about what HMS stands for. Fourth graders. Sorry, I have to confess. I had to go look up, see what HMS stands for. One of them was, these are British ships are named HMS whatever. One of the boys was saying it stands for Her Majesty's Service. And the other one said it stands for His Majesty's Service. Want to know the answer? Stands for both. But this guy's really intelligent. You want to know anything about a war that has taken place in our country's past? Get ready. Sit down for half an hour lecture. He could read a book, and he could tell you the book, including all kinds of details, but he couldn't summarize. And so these were some real issues that his therapist worked with. And the other thing that was interesting, she told me, I do not go head to head with this young man, because confrontation just upsets him. So I think there was an issue there that he's going to have to overcome in life sometime. But you and I know that any salesman, the first rule of any salesman is don't raise your possible customers, potential customers' defenses, because if you do, you've lost your sale. Another thing that is interesting is on the back, the rhythmic writing. And today, okay, years ago, students were taught two methods of writing things down, and that was with block printing and cursive writing. Today, the focus, there are many schools that are dropping cursive writing. They're going with block printing and keyboarding. Before you totally drop your cursive writing program, take a look at this. And you see all the basic swings of cursive writing. There is something, some connect to this and developing a brain that I think we'd be wise not to overlook. But these are some things that our teachers, that our therapists have done with our dyslexic students that have really given us some hope for some of these children. And you know, if we feel that we can spend for a number of different levels of the Susan Barton program, if we feel that we can spend a couple $1,000 and make the difference for three or four students, we feel it's worth it. Because, as I told you earlier, we have a boy and a girl that are dyslexic, and their dad exhibited symptoms of dyslexia back when he was in my classroom. He is still struggling with halting reading today. And with other productive citizens? Yes. Would he study in his spare time? No. Would he accept an adult Sunday school class? No. Because he said his comprehension's so poor. Just to give you an idea what I'm talking about, this boy, Keith, that's in my classroom, that is dyslexic, his therapist asked him, what do you think when you read? And he said, or what do you see in your mind when you read? And he said, I don't see anything. So let me give you an example of a sentence. The brown dog chased after the car, or ran after the car. He sees a dog. No, well, to start with, he didn't even see a dog. But she said, well, think about what I'm talking about. So he said, I see a dog. Was he seeing a brown dog? No. Then he went to the word ran,
And what did he see? He saw himself running. He didn't see the dog. He saw himself running. And then after that, the car. By the time he saw the car, he no longer saw the dog. Things are so disjointed for some of these people, we've got to do something to help them connect their dots. And so if you meet up with us, I'll tell you, just go online and you're probably going to read more than you have time for, but make a difference in somebody's life. Thank you for your attention, and I think it's time to close.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.